Welcome back to Big Mike's Movie Podcast, the audio companion to Big Mike's Movie Blog, which can be found at www.bigmikesmovieblog.com. My guest for this episode is a good friend of mine, college educated, unlike so many other people on this podcast, including me, a scholar, a poet, my good friend from all the way from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Miss Andrea, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. That's a really great intro. I kind of want to meet that chick. I don't really know who she is, so.
She's pretty cool. You should hang out with her sometime.
Yeah, I'm going to try. I'm going to try to meet her.
Yeah. She always has really good weed, too. The reason I have you on this episode, which is entitled The Godfather of All Podcasts, is because we're going to talk about one of our favorite movies today, The Godfather.
Definitely, it's my number one. There's no movie that can even touch The Godfather. There's nothing in my mind that is better than The Godfather. So now, I'm really excited to be here talking about it.
I'm excited to have you on. Now, what's interesting is that you are, and forgive me if I'm using the term incorrectly here, a feminist.
I am.
And the Godfather film, the entire series, is a series of films that are especially noted for being very masculine. Chauvinist would even be a good word for them. Very male-centric, from a very male point of view. It's all about men in power, doing things that we like to do, eat and kill and subjugate women, as it were. How in your mind as a feminist, what attracts you to the Godfather series?
You know, that's actually something that's come up before, and I don't ever have a really good solid answer. I think that feminists are pigeonholed, that we only like, you know, like Ani DiFranco music and, films about, I don't know, Sylvia Plath, which, whatever, that's fine for people who do, but I think when I watch The Godfather, there are times when I watch it from a feminist perspective and I can really look at, okay, how is patriarchy working in this? How is power working in this? Really looking at it as, you know, this is definitely a man's movie. This is a movie about men for men. And then I think there's the other side of it when I watch it, that it's just, there's so much to it, and it's such a good storyline, and it's so well done, and it's so well written, and it's hard not to love it. And so I don't really have an answer for you about, as a feminist, how is it that it's possible to love The Godfather? I've been asked, as a feminist, how is it that you, one of your favorite songs is Ain't No Fun by Snoop Dogg? But,
and
you know,
Nate Dogg.
And Warren G, let's not forget.
Right?
You know, it's one of my favorite songs. I am a lover of hip hop. I love everything about hip hop. And so one could call me a hypocrite. I like to call myself a complex contradiction. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's the way I answer it so that I don't piss off the feminists, because then they'll take away my card.
Well,
and they have a great health club, so you
like
know.
The song says, "Hey, now you know." Do you remember the first time you ever saw The Godfather?
You know, I remember watching it a lot growing up. I can't pinpoint the first time I ever saw it. But it's my mom's favorite movie. And, you know, growing up, it would come out on TV all the time. And every time it was on, we would watch it. And so I think part of my love for The Godfather is just that memory of my mom just being so happy when it would come on. And, you know, it was done in the early 70s, and, you know, up until that point, and even I would say now, you know, we don't see a lot of movies with Latinos, and we don't see a lot of movies with Chicanos or Mexicans or whatever. And I think here we had this movie with men with dark brown hair who were ethnic, who were Catholic, and it just captured my mom. And I think that had a lot to do with it, is that it's familiar. It's familiar to people, you know, from all walks of life, but I think particularly to Chicanos, because we don't have any movies or up until that point, we didn't have any movies that we could identify with that didn't make us look, you know, sort of like that cheesy Frito Bandito stereotype. And so growing up, I just thought it was this really cool movie because my mom really loved it. But later, probably, you know, my early 20s is when I really started watching it and really looking at it as this is a really good film, you know, and I really started to love it. And to this day, anytime it comes on TV, it doesn't matter that I own the DVD. Anytime it comes on TV, it could be the last five minutes of the movie. I'm going to stop and watch it. And so really there, it's sort of like it's always been a part of my life. There's really not this point where I remember watching it for the first time.
Except for that, except for last night when you were at your slumber party and couldn't be bothered to watch part one and part two.
There was no cable at the house where I was at for number one. And number two, I was at a slumber party. Come on.
Plus it's on AMC, so they're cutting out all the good stuff anyways. So
yeah, you know, we don't get to see, we don't see boobs, we don't see sex, we don't see, you know, we don't hear the curse words. It isn't worth it. Not last night anyway. Other times, yeah, it's fine. Especially if I want to have the kids watch it.
It's like watching The Sopranos on A&E. That's funny, though, that you grew up watching it. That's curiouser and curiouser.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of censorship of what I was able to watch growing up.
Clearly not. Clearly not. But the fact that you talk about it, how you just love it and enjoy it, but you can look at it, you know, from a more academic standpoint and with your knowledge of, you know, not only the psychology behind it, but just, you know, the cinematic aspects of it. Like, the first time I ever really sat through and watched the whole thing was in a film class I took in high school. And it was one of those movies where it really, like, I just, like, obviously I love it. And just, you know, just am so enthralled in the story whenever it comes on. You know, I gotta watch it and stuff like that, too. But really, like, it was one of those movies where you kind of, it's almost like a course in film studies by itself. You know, you really learn about all the different aspects of the different movie making, from the music and Gordon Willis's photography and, you know, the whole script and direction and everything. And so much that went on making the movie, you know, it was really important.
And it was a game changer in the gangster genre, in the gangster flick genre. It was a game changer because up until that point, you know, gangster flicks were very much like B movies, you know, lots of like the wise guys and James Cagney and sort of like, you know, everything had C in it, you know. So, you know, you're gonna go into the vault, C, and you're going to give me all your money, C. And it was just this, you know, the fedoras and the turned up collars.
Was
and
that
it
was your Cagney?
I didn't try to do any Cagney. I was doing verbatim so that I didn't have to try to do the accent because I knew you would clown me, which you did anyway, but
no, whatever. It was good.
It was not good. Are you kidding?
Look, anyway. Don't invalidate my opinion by saying it was not good. It was good. Your Edward G. Robinson is terrible, but your James Cagney is not bad.
You know, I'm still working on my Katharine Hepburn. I'll let you know on another podcast. You know, up until that point, you know, Humphrey Bogart, there were just like these really sort of bad movies with these shootouts. And, you know, pre-code, there were a lot of gangster flicks that probably had the potential to be good, but then they had to be tamed down. So here we have The Godfather. And for the first time, we see The Godfather as, you know, or we see a gangster, we see the mafia, and we see wives, and we see children. And the movie opens at a celebration, you know, at his daughter's wedding. And we begin to learn the intricacies of mafia. And with part two, you know, we begin to see, you know, how the rise to power and the whole reason for the mafia and the whole reason why people needed to protect themselves, which, you know, we can get into a little bit later. But it was a game changer. I mean, if there was no Godfather, in my opinion, there would be no Goodfellas. There would be no Casino. There would be no Gangs of New York. There would be no Sopranos. The Godfather really put a human aspect, a spin on sort of the way we looked at mafia. And it actually made us root for the bad guy. You know, you wanted to see the Godfather come out on top. I cheer every single time I see Michael kill Sollozzo and McCluskey, you know, in that famous scene in the restaurant. That's, you know, you cheer for the bad guy because it poses the question, who really is the bad guy? You know, who really is the bad guy? Who is really corrupt? You know, Michael poses the question to Kay in the movie, and he says to her, you know, now who's being naive, when she's trying to say that politicians aren't corrupt. And he just point blank says it. And, you know, so that movie really was, I think The Godfather, you know, when it came out, just completely changed the genre forever.
Who's your favorite character?
Michael.
Why Michael?
Oh, he changes so much and he's so dynamic. You know, people always say The Godfather is their favorite or Sonny was their favorite because, you know, Sonny was that caricature mobster in the film. He, you know, with the bad temper and womanizer and very violent. But Michael, in the beginning, was this clean-cut soldier, you know, with his very, very waspy girlfriend. And explained his family very honestly and made no apologies for them, but also made it very clear that he was going to distance himself until they needed him. And the minute they needed him, my favorite scene of Michael is after McCluskey breaks his face, and he's sitting in his father's study, and he's sitting in that leather chair, and he begins plotting out how he's going to take out Sollozzo and McCluskey. And he's so calm when he's doing it. And he's, you know, he's very calculating. And that's when we see that he's a genius. And, you know, Sonny makes fun of him and sort of does the whole kid brother thing with him. But Michael is very, very strong in his conviction. And from there, you know, he just that's where we start to see his rise of power. And when he has to go to Sicily and he's talking to who would be his father-in-law eventually, and he tells him, you know, he basically makes him an offer he can't refuse. And just how Michael changes so much, and he's such a dynamic character. I think that's what you know, why I really like him. And, you know, Al Pacino at that time, before his face fell, not bad to look at. Very, very handsome man.
Young Al Pacino.
Young Al Pacino.
The pre-shouty Al Pacino.
Before, you know, I don't know.
Hoo-ah! Gonna before call gravity the took mayor. It. Before, you know, before Scarface and Heat, where he just started screaming. But see, that scene is actually one of my favorite scenes, too. But for my favorite character, Tom Hagen, like, he, to me, he is the foundation. He's the rock of the Corleone family. Like, no matter what's going on, you know, he's there when you know, when Vito goes down, when Sonny goes down, when Michael comes up, Tom Hagen's always there. And they cast him aside at the end of the first one. And I think it's a huge reason, you know, for the events of the second one. But in that scene too, that you're talking about, where Michael's, you know, running down the plan for everybody and telling them how it's gonna go, there's this shot of Robert Duvall, this reaction shot, where he just kind of like slumps his shoulders and shakes his head a little bit. And you can tell that it's something that he always knew was coming, but never really wanted to happen. And he's just kind of reluctantly accepting that this is the next phase for this family, and that Michael's come to this side of the family business that I think that both he and Vito probably never really wanted for Michael. And they talk about it later. You know, Vito talks about him in that scene, that Robert Towns scene, where he said they always wanted something different for Michael, and now maybe it'll be the next generation or something. But, like I've always said, if they'd just listened to Tom Hagen from the very beginning, never would have had these Sollozzo problems. You know, they should have just got in on the drug trade when they can. Keep it to the schools and, you know, the colors and stuff like that.
Wow. I hope that your listeners understand that that was a quote from the meeting of the five families.
No, I said that myself.
Lest I be accused of cavorting with racists.
Now, you recently read the novel.
Yes, I did. I actually read it in the fall of 2009. I had never read the novel before and felt sort of silly that I loved The Godfather so much and hadn't read it. So I did. I was sick and I stayed in bed a week reading it. And wow, it just enhanced so much about the movie for me. And it's vastly different from the movie. There's a lot that gets left out. you know, now that you were talking about Tom Hagen, in the book, it's very clear that Tom is not seen as a member of the family. It's very clear that he is an adopted son. You know, in the movie, they sort of always refer to him as a brother. He has a lot of love for the Godfather. The Godfather regards him as a son. In the novel, it's pretty clear. It's made really clear that he's, you know, welcomed and trusted within the family, but that he's not one of them. He is not a Corleone. He is not Italian. He's not Sicilian. And, you know, there's references that Sonny makes, because Sonny is has such a bad temper, and he flies off the handle and says very hurtful things to Tom. But the novel showcases that much more. And the novel also gives us more background on Luca Brasi, who is probably one of the funniest characters in the movie, but in the book, he's very much a demon and he's evil. You know, and so it's really interesting who got left out and who, sort of rose to more prominence from the novel. Lucy Mancini, the bridesmaid that Sonny has an affair with, in the novel has a lot of airtime, if you will, a lot of novel time. She's a really big part of the book. That and her engorged labia, which Mario Puzo, I'm not really sure why, just spent a lot of time, you know, describing her engorged labia, and that Sonny's manhood was really like the only one that could take it. So interesting.
Yeah, novel. When you talk about it so clinically, it doesn't sound as hot, but...
I didn't know that engorged labias were hot. Like, abnormally large vaginas turned you on, Mike. So
they don't. They don't.
Good to know.
No, they don't. And you're really making sure that they do not. I'm just saying. the way just I say. But
she's important to the novel because she actually ends up going to Las Vegas, and the doctor that, you know, fixes her lady problems becomes sort of important as well with the family's move out west. Johnny Fontaine, aka Frank Sinatra, has a really big role in the novel. There's a huge portion dedicated to him. And in the movie, we see very little of him, which I could do without him. I was fine with it. I was fine without him, Lucy. You know, I was fine without them in the movie, but I would have liked to have seen more about Luca Brasi. A side note, in the novel, it's made very clear that Waltz is a pedophile. You know, that he sleeps with his child stars, and Tom knows it, you know, and... the film very much glosses over that. And there's also in the novel a really ugly scene about Luca Brasi in which he gets a prostitute pregnant. And when she delivers the child, he throws the child in an incinerator. So there's some definite deep ugly to the novel that doesn't get put in the film. And so I think anyone who ever wants to argue that it's too violent of a film needs to read the novel. And then they'll feel a little bit better about the film.
Well, it's one of the very, very, very few cases where both the book and the film stand alone in their own regards, and both of them are brilliant.
Yes.
And you doesn't take knowledge of one to enjoy the other, and it only kind of enhances both of them rather than to take away from any of them.
Oh, I agree completely.
It's very weird. Plus, you know, the novel, it has all that great backstory on characters like Luca and Tom and Lucy and Dr. Jules and Johnny Fontaine and Johnny's friend. But it also sets up, you know, the whole backstory that comes in and becomes, you know, the other half of Godfather Part II, you know, with Vito's rise to power. And we get to see young Robert De Niro as the young Vito, as the young Marlon. And, you know, that's all set up there in the novel, too. So without that novel, I mean, obviously you can't have the movie without the novel, but you wouldn't even have part two without it. You wouldn't have, you know, the character. You wouldn't have the Andy Garcia character in part three because Lucy Mancini is, you know, the character in part one and, you know, crosses all the way over.
Well, but the novel makes it very clear that Lucy did not get pregnant from Sonny. it's very clear that she did not have his child and she was never pregnant from him. And so I think part three, well, just as a really quick note, I don't think part three should have ever been made. I think, you know, it's a terrible film. I said it. It's horrible. I find no merit in it. I can't see anything good about it. A lot of people try to say, oh, it tied up the loose ends. We got to see what happened to the Godfather. And really, you know, I was fine with the way part two ended, with Michael sort of just contemplating the fact that he had his brother killed and that he lost everything. I didn't need to see a part three. So part three, you know, really nothing of it comes from the novel. It's just, it's really made from the films, from part one and part two, but it wasn't done well. And I was very disappointed the first time I saw it, and I've tried to watch it several other times, and I can never really appreciate it. I can't find anything to appreciate about it.
Nothing?
Nothing. The one line of, you know, I keep trying to get out, but they keep pulling me back in. You know, but, you know, I just, there's nothing for me. Diane Keaton has a really bad perm. Sofia Coppola is a terrible actor. Great director, terrible actor. You know, Andy Garcia, nice to look at, but I have the internet, so.
But it's really, Andy Garcia. It's Andy Garcia. He's in.
Andy Garcia, but come on. I just hated him in that movie. I hate The Godfather Part
3. Just because he's Cuban doesn't mean we have to hate him. We should be supporting him. And I think you know that.
Oh, my goodness. No.
Along that same line, you talked about some of the bigger themes of The Godfather and why it's so familiar to you and I as mm-hmm. Chicano people, you know, that they're dark-skinned, they're Catholic. The film is bookended by two very important Catholic celebrations, a wedding and a baptism.
Right, exactly. And
it plays into this kind of idea, especially for, you know, immigrants or Catholics. But for society in general, Godfather has become part of our American mythology. You know, mm-hmm. Vito Corleone and Darth Vader and Rhett Butler are these huge characters in our history. And there are Greek heroes and there are, you know, Knights of the Round Table in this country. And why do you think, how do you think that The Godfather made that transition to become so larger than life and such an ingrained part of our culture?
I think it's a good film. I mean, it is so well done, so well written. It's you know, it just pulls you in and you can't help but fall in love with it. And it's so much a part of everything else that's done today. There's so many references to it in pop culture, in other films. The opening scene in Swingers, with the very young and thin Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau walking through a casino, and Vince Vaughn says to Jon Favreau, you know, let's find a couple of cocktail waitresses and pull a Fredo. You know, there's lots of references made to it in different cartoons, you know. One of the best clips of Family Guy, as you well know, is the one where Peter confesses he didn't like The Godfather. And Lois loses it with him. You know, it doesn't matter that Peter is a horrible husband and embarrasses her and is good for nothing, but the fact that he doesn't like The Godfather is enough to make her want to divorce him. And then we see Chris, who's sort of this bumbling idiot all the time, becomes very analytical and very smart. You know, and so just the way that Godfather influences everything that's done now, I think speaks volumes to how important of a film it is. And how important it was when it came out. It won, you know, so many awards, and it was different. And I think that's the key. It was different. It was something that was completely brand new to people, and it was epic. And part two is, you know, just such a perfect companion, because when we get to see how Vito rose to power and why he rose to power, you know, it wasn't like he was this malicious, diabolical, hateful demon of a man. He was a man who had basically, from the age of 9, he had to do whatever he had to do to survive. And the fact that he rose to power in the process, you know, in that survival, I think a lot of people can identify with. I think that, you know, it's really easy to sort of say, oh, he's just a thug, he's violent, you know. If you look at gang culture as it stands today, you know, oh, they're nothing but a bunch of troublemakers. But why do they exist in the first place? Why do gangs exist in the first place? Why did the mafia come to power? You know, if you look at it from a very, you know, sociology type of background, you're looking at, you know, you had people who basically felt like they were unprotected and that they were being oppressed and they were victims of, you know, a system that was supposed to take care of them. So they started taking care of themselves. I'm not condoning the violence, okay? But I am saying I understand. I get it, right? And I think The Godfather Part 2 really just helps us understand. And again, we root for the bad guy. You know, you want to root for the bad guy because really, is he that much of a bad guy? Now, Part 2, Michael, not my favorite character. Not really loving Michael in Part 2.
Well, that's the thing. That's what Coppola sets out to do with the second one, because the first one glorifies this violence and this way of life so much, this gangster mentality, that the second one is set up as the antithesis to the first one. And it works so well still as a movie. It could even possibly be better than the second one, but you can't have the first without the second, and you get into this whole snake eating its tail argument. But the reason that it's contrasted with Vito's rise to power, Michael's downfall, is to show that even though, you know, you start out with the best intentions and, you know, you're very honorable about it and it seems like you're doing the right thing and everything has a purpose, the end result is still a bad one and is still the destruction of your family. It's still the loss of everything that he works so hard to try to keep. He has everything by the end of the movie. He's established in Vegas. You know, the Corleone family is completely legit, but it's not a family anymore.
Right. And, you know, one of the best parts of The Godfather Part 2, I think, is when Fredo breaks down and he tells Michael, I was stepped over. I should have been in charge after Sonny, and I was stepped over. And, you know, then they kind of cut to this whole thing about how Fredo was so weak as a child. And we saw in Part 1 when Vito got shot, Fredo was useless and sort of had a mental breakdown and then went to Vegas and was trying to rebuild himself as, you know, powerful. And he ended up just sort of being Mo Green's whipping boy. And so, you know, in Part 2, when Fredo finally broke and said to Michael, I resented you, that was huge. That was such a huge point in the film. And, you know, I guess that's why Michael, I just didn't like Michael in Part 2, because there was nothing human about him anymore. He was a man in power and who had too much power and didn't really handle the power very well. And so, you know, there was no compassion. There was nothing to him that was human anymore. I think that was the difference between him and Vito, and where Vito didn't get to groom him to be the godfather that he needed him to be, because, you know, Vito died so early into Michael's rise of power. And if you, you know, really in the novel, going back to the novel quickly, Michael and Vito were actually at odds a lot, because Vito wanted, he actually was sort of trying to groom Michael for greatness, not necessarily in the family, but for greatness. And Michael resisted Vito at every turn. And so I think that was really evident in Part 2, that he didn't have his father's influence. And so he didn't have his father's finesse for ruling. He had the mind. He was brilliant, but he didn't have his finesse. Vito was very soft-spoken. Michael had a bad temper.
Well, you know. And as I was watching it last night, too, there's that great ending of Part 2 that they have to, that Coppola has to come up with quickly because he doesn't have Brando there. Michael tells them that he's joining the Marines. He's going to go, it's like the day after Pearl Harbor, or it's the day of Pearl Harbor, I can't remember. And, you know, they start arguing about, well, we had these plans for you, and your father wanted you to do this, and Michael's whole thing is, you know, it's not what my plans are, and I don't care what my father thinks. And to end the movie like that, it's just, when I was watching it last night and thinking about it, it struck me as odd that, you're right, he's resistant the whole time to the idea of coming around. And we already know that that's set up in the first one. But to bring it back like that, to bring it full circle for the second one, it just tonally, it struck me as odd last night for the first time. Why would you again show that he never really wanted to do this? Like, is that why he did it so poorly? Is that why he didn't do it as well as his father did? Because his heart was never really in it, you know? Obviously, when he was young, Michael, he didn't really care about his family. He didn't have the concerns about what the family's interests were. You know, right. It was selfish, and he only cared about what, you know, was in his own interest, to the point of where he openly defied his father and his father's wishes. And to set it up like that, you know, to come back to it, it's just so weird to me.
And, you know, I think, again, it's that whole issue of coming from a big family. I come from a big family. Michael is the youngest son. And there's expectations on him that sort of, you know, what the other people in the family didn't accomplish, it's sort of the dreams and hopes are pinned on him. And when he resists that, that's where we start to see sort of the breakdown and the fallout. In the movie, in part one, you know, it's Vito, that his disappointment in Michael is never shown. He refuses to take the family picture unless Michael's there. He is very deeply hurt when he finds out Michael is the person who did the hit on Sollozzo and McCluskey. And, you know, he loves his son very much, more so than I think he loves Sonny or Fredo. He loves his children, but I think he has, for lack of a better word, a cariño for Michael, a deep sort of affinity for him that he doesn't have for his other children. And I think Michael, being the youngest, is very indulged, and he's very spoiled in that sense. You know, it's interesting the way women are sort of played out in this movie. We have, you know, Mama Corleone, who is that sort of, you know, she's the matriarch of the family. You know, very much the, you know, grandmother, always holding a baby, always in the kitchen. We have Connie, who's the spoiled only daughter. She's the princess. Spoiled
guinea brat.
Yes, the spoiled guinea brat, according to her husband, Carlo. Which, can I just say as an aside, you know, the scene where Sonny beats him up is probably one of the best scenes of the movie. And it's, you know, it's one of those scenes where, again, that's what you wanted to see. You wanted to, you know, Carlo gives her a black eye. He gives Connie a black eye. And in the novel, actually, we read a lot more about how abusive he really was. He was abusive since the wedding night. So that was really kind of glossed over in the movie. Women are not in this movie. Let's just, you know, be very clear that women in The Godfather are nothing more than props. They're very much there for just sort of filler. They're really not, they're not important to the film at all, with a few exceptions, which I'll get to. But it's really interesting, you know, that Carlo gives Connie a black eye. Sonny comes to pick her up. He sees the black eye. He goes out. He beats beats the noodles out of Carlo.
Beats the noodles out of Carlo.
Beats the noodles. This is a family show. I don't want to...
That was being racist.
I don't want to beat the cuss words. I'll just be... Well, actually, I prefer the term bigot.
He beat prejudice. His spaghetti-bending butt back to Sicily.
On a crate of tomatoes. You know, and so when he beats him up, and it's just so good, you know, and he says to him, you know, if you ever touch my sister again, and he heaves, I'll kill ya. It's just, it's great. It's great. But again, that's a scene that's about Sonny and Carlo. It has nothing to do with Connie. Women are not important to this film. Now, we have a few exceptions, obviously. When Michael is living in Sicily, he marries the very young, very beautiful Apollonia, who is tragically killed in a car explosion that was meant for Michael.
Spoiler alert if anybody hasn't seen the movie.
If you haven't seen the movie, then there's something wrong with you, and you don't deserve to be surprised anyway.
Don't talk to my listeners like that. They're listening to this, and now they want to go see it, and they're like, ah, she blows up. They don't get to enjoy Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Wednesday, Saturday.
It would be easier to teach your English than to drive.
less dangerous.
Or safer. Rather. I'm sorry, we've been giving away the whole movie throughout this conversation.
Yeah, but you just gave him the big one. Even when Vito gets shot the first time, he doesn't die. The movie's got a lot of, like, twists where there's a lot of things that it almost attempts to fall into the cliches, but then it doesn't a lot of times.
Well, like, go ahead and edit that part out if it's going to make you feel better.
No, why would it make me feel better? This isn't about me. This is about The Godfather.
Exactly. So, back to women. So, Apollonia, you know, is an important character because she's important to Michael's years in Sicily. But again, it's about patriarchy. It's about looking at the traditions. It's about, you know, the sort of American coming back to his roots and really not understanding the customs, but going along with them so he can have his young virgin bride. Meanwhile, in America, he had Kay, his wasp, who, you know, didn't understand the family. But they accepted her. They were okay with it. It's kind of like when your cousin brings home, you know, a nonchalant, and it's kind of like, oh, okay. And she doesn't get it, but she's trying, and she makes chili weird, and she doesn't know how to make beans, and you're like, okay, that's okay. You know, you just go with it. And I think that's how the family treated Kay. Kay was an interesting character because I think Kay didn't understand. She didn't get it. And so at the end of the movie, when she's asking Michael if he had anything to do, you know, with Carlo, and he's telling her to stay out of his business, you can't help but think, yeah, you know, you don't get it because you're not Italian. You know, and that is an extremely sexist thing to say, I understand. But, you know, there are those nuances and those differences, and we see them explode in part two, where, you know, Kay does the unthinkable. And I remember watching it with someone, a friend, who actually cheered when Michael finally hit her, sort of to put her back in her place. And that really felt unsettling for me, that there, you know, because we love The Godfather so much, because here's this woman who doesn't understand, you know, what it is to be Italian or Catholic or whatever, that, you know, we sort of, you know, there's like this sort of like feeling of vindication when Michael finally hits her. It's kind of like, yes, let her know. And it's unsettling for me in a lot of ways. And I think that's what part two does, is it brings us back to really how bad this stuff is, you know, how bad the violence is. And this is actually not a good way of lifestyle, where part one is very romantic. It makes the mafia just look so romantic and so wonderful. But yeah, women, not a real big deal. Not a real big deal in this movie. And, you know, that's okay. It really is. It is okay. Not every movie has to have sort of that feminist balance to it. But I think it's really interesting that, you know, women really are just props. And especially when looking at the novel, that women do have a more prominent role. Mama has a more prominent role. You know, her relationship with Kay, we see that a lot more. And it was very purposely omitted from the movie because it was meant to be very much about the men.
Connie takes on a larger role in the second movie, though, as well. Becoming, coming back to the family and coming back to Michael, and kind of serving him almost as her place as the new matriarch of the family, you know. So
there was no transition for that, though. That's what was really interesting, is there was no transition for Connie coming back to the family. There was no context for it. She's a really bad mother, you know, getting married every few months to different men who are just using her for her money. You know, and then she's gone for a really long time, and then sort of comes back and begs Michael to let her back in and to take care of him. But, you know, she just completely becomes subservient, but there's really no context for it. And again, it's just sort of that whole thing that women are not important to this film. You know, they're not central characters. There's nothing complex about them. They're very one-dimensional characters. They're either, you know, like that very like subservient, you know, take care of the family matriarchal role, or, you know, they're this very evil sort of, you know, out to be the downfall of the family sort of role. But there's nothing complex about them. You know, there's no, we don't get to see how she changes. We got to see how Michael changes. We see all of the ways which Fredo sort of just loses it. And we see all of that. But with Connie, we don't. We just see her, you know, in this really fabulous haircut at the beginning of the film, you know, compared to how they had her. She was sort of dowdy. You know, her hair was just sort of pinned up with a barrette. Second film, she looked great. Maybe she was, you know, kind of whoring it up a little, but she looked great. And then all of a sudden is back as the matriarch and she's begging Michael's forgiveness, but we don't really see how come. We don't see what was sort of the epiphany for her. She wasn't important.
Part one stands alone as a masterpiece of American cinema. Part two is almost as perfect. It's companion. Part three, obviously, you don't really care for it. Most people don't, you know.
I could have done without it.
It has its merits. But, you know, it's not part one or part two. There's been talk of a part four.
You know, I think sometimes you just gotta leave well enough alone. And I am really not okay with a part four. Do I need to know about young Sonny? I guess it would depend on who's writing it, who's acting in it, who's directing it. You know, it would take a lot to win me over. You know, and we see now so many films being redone. You know, some films that were, you know, really good the first time around, Manchurian Candidate. Some films, Footloose, really don't need to see it remade. I think if there was a remake of The Godfather, I think I would lose my mind, to be quite honest. I think I would take to the streets in protest, because I think that it's a beautiful film. You know, the American Film Institute ranked it as the number two film of all time. You know, the equally prestigious Entertainment Weekly ranked it as the number one film of all time.
Wow. Did you just compare Entertainment Weekly to the AFI?
As being facetious for all the listeners who don't know me. And a side note, Footloose is my guilty pleasure film, so I will not be seeing the new one.
Everybody has guilty pleasures.
You know, you can't mess with Kevin Bacon.
I own glitter. And,
you know, Chris Penn dancing in a cornfield with Kevin Bacon. It's a beautiful moment. But, you know, the Godfather is ranked as the best film, or the second best film of all time, and it would be a tragedy, I think, to just keep messing with it because it's so popular. I mean, I know there's a video game, which I don't play video games. I haven't played it. I've heard it's kind of cool. I don't know.
The video game is sick.
Is it?
Like, if you've never played it, it is so awesome because it has Brando's voice. It has Jimmy Conn's voice. It has Robert Duvall's voice. And you, like, get to play out all these scenes from the movies. And the music and the violence is all in it. And it's so... I love that video game. That video game is actually really cool. Second one, Godfather Part 2, not so much. But the first Godfather game is pretty awesome.
I might have to check it out because I'm not a video game person, obviously. But, you know, anything for the Godfather, as Johnny Fontaine would say. You know, I don't think you can ever recreate that scene. And spoiler alert, you know, press pause, kids. The last scene of the movie, when Michael takes care of all the family business and he handles all the leaders, you know, and gets rid of everyone. And it's so beautiful. And that organ music that's playing, and he's baptizing Connie's son. And, you know, Michael, do you reject Satan? And Michael is saying, I do. And meanwhile, all of these people are being murdered on his order. I don't see how anyone could even think to redo that. And, you know, one of the biggest things that bothered me about The Sopranos was the use of cell phones. It drove me crazy. The whole time I watched that show, it always bothered me, the use of cell phones. The Godfather didn't have any of that. There was no warning. There was, you know, no way of tracking. There were no GPS devices. There was, you know, when Michael was going to go and shoot Sollozzo and McCluskey, you know, they didn't know until McCluskey signed out and told the precinct where he was going to be. You know, that's suspense. That's terrifying when you don't know if Michael's going to make it out alive. And even now, when I know what's going to happen, I'm still terrified. And so I don't see how, if there could ever be a remake, I don't see how it could be done as well as the original Godfather was done. I don't see it. Again, I'm a fan of film. I am not an insider of film. I'm not, you know, I don't know the tricks of the trade. I'm purely a fan, and I don't see how it could even be messed with. I don't see it. So
somewhere, somebody is working on the idea of remaking it. Maybe they have a star. Maybe they have a star in mind. Maybe they have somebody. You know, it could be a director they have in mind, or an actor, someone they're grooming. You know. Singing lessons, acting lessons, dancing lessons.
Let me be more frank with you.
I just had to throw that in there. That waltz speech is like one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I was going to make her a big star.
Oh, man. I love it. I love it. She was the best piece of ass.
Then here comes Johnny Fontaine with his olive oil voice and guinea charm.
And he ruined her. And I love watching The Godfather with people who have never watched it before. And if you haven't seen The Godfather, go and get it today and watch it. And I love taking Godfather virginity. It's sport for me. I love it. I'm like, oh, you haven't seen The Godfather? Interesting. Play. You know, it's the best thing ever. You know, give someone a little bit of wine, make them feel a little relaxed about the whole thing, and then make the move. It's amazing.
Adjectives fail me. Right now, give him a little wine. Well, hey, why don't you come up to my place and I'll show you my etchings.
I only prefer people who haven't seen The Godfather. If you're a Godfather whore, I have no use for you.
Well, I'm glad you found a little bit of time to make for me on this podcast.
But I'm honored to be a part of this podcast because I love The Godfather so much.
I know you do.
Favorite movie.
I'll have to have you back sometime. We'll talk about gender roles in romantic comedies. Because like to argue about that all the time.
Okay, we could talk about some gender roles in some romantic comedies. I was hoping that you would have me on to talk about the merits of Teen Wolf versus Teen Wolf 2, but...
I like Jason Bateman, so don't get me started on Teen Wolf 2.
I know, you do have a big man crush on Jason Bateman.
I do, so. It's Michael Bluth.
Yeah, you know, love Michael Bluth. Love him.
All things named Michael are pretty good, so...
Nice. Did not see that one coming.
That's what she said.
I did not care for The Godfather.
What?
Did not care for The Godfather.
How can you even say that, Dad?
Didn't like it.
Peter, it's so good. It's like the perfect movie.
This is what everyone always says. Whenever they say, oh,
Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. You never see... Robert Duvall!
Fine actor. Did not like the movie.
Why not?
Couldn't get into it.
Explain yourself. What didn't you like about it?
It insists upon itself, Lois.
What?
It insists upon itself.
What does that even mean?
Because it has a valid point to make. It's insistent.
It takes forever getting in. You know, you spend like 6.5 hours, and then, you know, I can't even get through. I can't even finish a movie. I've never even seen the ending.
You've never seen the ending?
Well, how can you say you don't like it if you haven't even given it a chance?
I agree with Joey. It's not really fair.
I have tried on 3 separate occasions to get through it, and I get to the scene where all the guys are sitting around on the easy chairs.
Yeah, it's a great scene. I love that scene.
It's been noted in every annal.
I have no idea what they're talking about. It's like they're speaking a different language. That's where I lose interest and I go away.
They're speaking Italian!
The language they're speaking is a language of subtlety, something you don't understand.
I love the money pit. That is my answer to that statement.
Exactly.
Well, there you go.
Whatever.
I like that movie, too.